Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to your house, our house, Africana Studies and Research Center. My name is Femi Taiwo, and for this moment, I happen to be the current chair of this center. And I'm always overjoyed when we call on you and you say yes to coming to hanging out with us again. May you never find a reason not to come and hang out with us. May we never do things that will make you not want to come and hang out with us. So please keep it going. I'm glad to have you here. And in a moment, I'll hand you over to my colleague, Professor Richard Richardson. My job is just to welcome you and welcome our special guest, Professor Terry Jones, whom I'm yet to meet and I'm meeting now. And definitely, I hope, actually I'm not hoping. I'm sure whatever happens here going forward this afternoon will reward the time that you have chosen to expend on us. Welcome. Thank you.
I want to start just with a prelude and show a brief video for us this afternoon. And as we all welcome Professor Terry Jones to Cornell.
Dear young students, I'm writing to you because I care about you. I've not met you, but we're connected in the sense that you and your generation are the future of my community, my country, and my world. I believe that young people like you and elders like me must learn from each other. There's an African proverb that says, the young can go fast, the elders know the way. Over the course of my life, I've learned many lessons. I want to share three of them with you as you continue on your life's journey. A good education is not only important if you want to make a good living, it's also a key to living a good life. A quality education will prepare you for whatever profession you wish to follow. And because your generation will change jobs and professions several times in the course of your life, a good education will prepare you to make those changes. A quality education is also important if you want to live a good life. That is how you will not only learn about your own history and culture, you will learn about the history and culture of people who are different from you. Early in my life, I also learned the importance of being of service to others. I was taught that doing for others is just the rent you gotta pay for your room on earth. That lesson was reinforced as I watched how my parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, the members of my church, individuals in my community, looked after each other. Whether I'm engaging in a simple act of kindness or an ongoing service activity, what I am doing for others, it comes back to me tenfold in the form of a mighty good feeling. The third lesson I have learned is the importance of courage. Dr. Maya Angelou, one of the great writers of our time and a civil rights leader, once said this: courage is the most important of all of the virtues, because without courage, you can't practice any other virtue consistently. It takes courage to speak up when you witness someone being attacked because of their race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, disability, or any other identity. It takes courage to do what you know is the right thing to do when others are urging you to follow them in doing what is clearly not the right thing to do. It takes courage to do everyday acts like saying, I'm sorry, you offended someone, or to forgive when someone has offended you and ask for forgiveness. It takes courage to be your authentic self, rather than doing what others are doing, when if you do, it is a violation of who you are. It can take courage to refuse to give up after you have repeatedly failed at doing something that's important. There's a Japanese saying that reminds me of this. It says, down six, up seven. If you have not done so already, I hope each of you will fall madly in love with learning. May you always be of service to others, and may you always have the courage to do what you know is the right thing to do. On Johnetta Batch Cole.
Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayukono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayukono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayukono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. This land acknowledgement has been reviewed and approved by the traditional Gayukono leadership. I want to thank everyone for coming out today from across campus and the larger community, as well as other places. I applaud Cindy Grieco, Bob Weiss, and the A.D. White Professor at Large program in general, and thank faculty, staff, and students who are here today for attending various events this week as well in some cases. I also want to thank our administrative staff, Treva Levine, Eric, and Hannah Langtry, who's starting out with us today, for their work in helping to coordinate this event along with its co-sponsors. It is so much my delight and honor to introduce the award-winning New York Times best-selling novelist Tiare Jones's keynote talk today as an A.D. White professor at large, whom I am delighted to help give a heartfelt welcome to the campus as the faculty co-host for this visit, alongside Ishion Hutchinson. According to the program, Cornell's first president, A.D. White, had noted that Cornell's location was remote from great cities and centers of thought and action, and could cause our community to become disconnected and provincial in spirit. So he proposed a system of non-resident professors. At the university's 100th anniversary, which was founded in 1865, the A.D. White Professor at Large program was formally established to bring the world's greatest scientists, artists, and scholars to campus. The goal of this program is to bring accomplished and distinguished individuals to Cornell to advance the intellectual and creative life of the campus and community of Cornell through interactions with students, staff, faculty, and members of the broader local community in a manner that transcends traditional boundaries of academic disciplines. A.D. White professors at large are appointed for 6-year terms, and during that period, engage in 2 to 3 immersive campus visits. There are currently 19 A.D. White professors at large, spanning the arts, humanities, life sciences, physical sciences, and social sciences. Current appointees include Nobel laureates, MacArthur awardees, Pulitzer Prize winners, Grammy awardees, Emmy award winners, members of the National Academy of Sciences, etc. Prior AB Wright professors at large include John Cleese, Jane Goodall, Wynton Marsalis, Barbara McClintock, Toni Morrison, and many other remarkable individuals. You can find the full list on the website of the AB Wright Professor at Large program. This week, the Tiare Tracker hashtag, the hashtag that documented and followed her events in national and global context in the months after the publication of her award-winning novel, An American Marriage, gained new meaning and came to mind while witnessing and hearing about the extraordinary impact she has made through her encounters with faculty, students, and staff engaged in so many dynamic dialogues. Already, her impact has been quite profound. It's like we need our own Tiare Tracker here right at Cornell. On Tuesday, after she visited my first year writing seminar, The African American Short Story, one of the students wrote me this note. Dear Professor Richardson, I hope you are doing well. I wanted to let you know I really enjoyed class today, and I found the conversation with Tiare Jones to be very insightful and inspiring. Please pass on my gratitude and thanks to her. Thank you. Tiare's special and deeply engaging way of telling stories, teaching, dialoguing, and connecting with people also came to mind last night at Statler as we walked into the dining room, where a table of about 10 students were seated from the back, toward the back, whom we greeted. In the dim light, she asked, "Isn't that one of your students, the second from the right?" Indeed, the same student had stayed a few minutes after class the day before to ask more questions and for a photo with her. The testimonies about Tiare's impact that I have heard this week have all attested to how phenomenal and brilliant she is as a teacher, writer, literary critic and cultural theorist, and an analyst. Just like my students, I first met the person whom I introduced to them as Professor Jones during my freshman year at Spelman College when she was a junior, serving as the editor of this literary magazine, then entitled Focus, to which I submitted two poems for consideration that year, and then as a campus reporter on the staff of the Spelman Spotlight newspaper, for which she worked as one of the editors. In the latter context, she helped assign my stories and edit them. Her seriousness and passion about her writing were evident even then. I admired her deeply and learned a lot from her example and peer mentoring. Then as now, she is among my dearest and most cherished Spelman sisters. And over the years, I have truly treasured our friendship within the special Spelman sisterhood. The image of the continents on planet Earth with Spelman's campus mapped at the heart of it, the holiday greeting cards sent out to all Spelman students and alumni during my sophomore year and Tiare senior, beautifully illustrated that Spelman is global and that the women of Spelman and his sisterhood can be found everywhere in the world and are ever on a mission to help make it better. This was a time when the continuing commitment of our campus to service under the leadership of our beloved sister president, Dr. Janetta B. Cole, had garnered recognition by President George H.W. Bush as one of the nation's 1,000 points of light. In addition to being a Spelman sister and dear friend, I am now delighted, excited, and honored to call you a colleague here at Cornell and to see you sharing and shining so brightly in your own special light here on campus. And to help welcome Tiare to my home department, the Africana Studies and Research Center, like his other friends, Toni Morrison, John Bracey, Dorothy Cotton, Gloria Joseph, Jackie Melton Scott, and so many others. We are delighted and extend a warm welcome to you to the Africana Studies and Research Center today, and hope that you continue to feel and find a home here during your tenure in this capacity and continuing forward. The vision of Nobel laureate Toni Morrison helped us challenge conventional canonical notions that center whiteness and to increasingly recognize the relevance and representativeness of Black experience for thinking about human experiences in national and global contexts. We too are America, it suggests, to echo the words of Langston Hughes' famous poem. This is the premise from which novelist Tiare Jones writes and works among a new generation of writers positioned at its vanguard, while also importantly helping to reshape Southern literature, which is exciting to see to me as a Black Southern woman, artist, and scholar within the field of Southern studies, a field that Professor Jones's innovative fiction is also energizing. This is an area to which her keynote today speaks. What We Answer To, A Southern Daughter's Reflection. Tiare Jones is the author of the novels Leaving Atlanta, The Untelling, Silver Sparrow, and An American Marriage, which was a 2018 Oprah's Book Club selection and won the 2019 Aspen Words Literary Prize and the 2019 Women's Prize for Fiction. Her writing has appeared in Tin House, The Believer, The New York Times, and Callaloo. A member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers, she has also been a recipient of the Hurston Wright Legacy Award, a Lifetime Achievement Award in Fine Arts from the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, a United States Artist Fellowship, an NEA Fellowship, a Radcliffe Institute Bunting Fellowship, and a 2021 Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship in Fiction. Silver Sparrow was named a number one indie next pick by booksellers in 2011, and the NEA added it to its Big Read Library of Classics in 2016. Professor Jones is a graduate of Spelman College, the University of Iowa, and Arizona State University. She joined the faculty of Emory University's Creative Writing Program in fall 2018. Please join me in welcoming Tiare Jones to speak to us today.
And I feel like the kind of work that we're doing at our universities, and when I say we, I mean us specifically. I understand that other people at other universities that are doing things that are not toward this goal, but I feel like the work that we're doing is the work that will save us. As this is my first visit as an AD White professor, I wanted to take this keynote address as an opportunity to introduce myself to you and to express my gratitude. So who am I? Well, in the 33 years since I graduated from Spelman College, I have lived in the following places: Iowa City, Houston, Athens, Georgia, Tempe, Arizona, Johnson City, Tennessee, Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, Washington, D.C., Jersey City, Brooklyn, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Las Vegas. This nomadic life was all in service to my desire to write novels. I bounced from institution to institution, opportunity to opportunity, all because each afforded me the means and time to concentrate on art. And while I don't regret these choices, I don't know that I would exactly recommend this path to anyone that would come behind me. But this is the road that I've taken, and it is one less traveled that in turn required a lot of traveling. And because of all the miles that I have put on my personal odometer, you would think that I would stutter or at least pause when someone asked me that simple icebreaker question. Where are you from? Atlanta, I answer without hesitation. When the question is posed when I'm outside of the Peach State, this one word is sufficient. But when I'm in my hometown, this is merely the first line of inquiry. It goes something like this. Let's see if I can do this. Where are you from? Atlanta. Oh, what part? Southwest. Where at? Cascade. But what high school? Benjamin Mays. Oh, you're a grade baby? Yes, but I was technically born in Hugh Spalding. Oh, you're fancy then. Did you go to Spelman? Class of 1991. Ha, I knew it. I could tell as soon as you walked in the door. I find great comfort in being so easily identified after so many wandering years. It is ironic that my writing took me so far from home, but it was my memories and longing for that very same home in which I discovered my voice and my subject matter. And ultimately, it was my writing that brought me back where I belonged. My first novel, Leaving Atlanta, is a coming-of-age story set against the backdrop of the Atlanta child murders. When I was a child in Atlanta in the 1970s and early 80s, there was a serial killer that killed about 29 Black children. And we say about, people disagree on how many children were killed. People disagree because records at that time were not well kept about the lives of Black children. And then there was this thing where some children were considered to be officially murdered on the list, and others, I don't know, unofficially murdered. Two of the children were students at my elementary school. After the murders, after someone was arrested and the murders seemed to have stopped, as a group, Atlanta decided to stop talking about this. I was not curious as to why the larger American society did not talk about these murdered children. We all know the answer to that question. But I was very curious as to why those of us who experienced it had decided to behave as though it had not happened. I knew that I wanted to write about this subject when I was a student in college. I used to babysit a little boy and I would tutor him in math. Me, I tutor someone in math. So you know how small he was. And I went to the corner to pick him up where he was to get off the school bus, and I looked for him and I could not find him. And this provoked such a panic in me. I ran back to campus and I was telling everyone that I couldn't find him and begging people to help me look. And most people said something along the lines of, oh, you know, he'll be fine. He's probably just at Popeye's getting some chicken or something. And I understood that this. And everyone who helped me look for him was someone else who had grown up in Atlanta. At the time, I thought it was that kind of hometown kinship thing you do in college. You know, we're all homegirls together, so they're going to help me. But I should say, when I found him, he was at Popeye's eating chicken, just as all rational people suspected. I realized it was because we had grown up together in Atlanta, and we had this trigger, this memory. And I thought someone should write about this. But at that time in my life, I didn't know that someone was me. Flash forward to when I was in graduate school studying creative writing. I was starting to write a coming of age story. And what I know of coming of age involves the backdrop of these murders. But I wasn't sure if I was going to write about it. I don't know. I kind of didn't quite feel up to it, or I felt like it was a job for someone else, someone more skilled, someone more something, in the way that we can often think of ourselves as young people, not quite ready. I was at a reception. And I mentioned to someone that I had grown up during this time of these murders. And the person said, oh my goodness, she said, I bet you didn't even have a childhood. And it really rubbed me the wrong way, because to tell someone that they didn't have a childhood is telling them they lack humanity. Childhood is a human experience. And regardless of what may have happened in the city of Atlanta during my childhood, it did not mean that I was not a child. I had been a child and I had a childhood. And so I decided that I would be the one to write about growing up in Atlanta during the child murders. I did not want to write about the murders. I was not interested in the whodunit. I did not want this to be a story about the state. I feel that when you write things as a police procedural or something, it becomes about the state. And I wanted it to be about the community and about those of us who grew up at that time. What was it to come of age in the wake of these murders? And so I thought that by way of a little introduction of what I do and how I do it, I would read a short bit from that book. So I'm going to read to you from the section of, from the point of view of a young girl. Her given name is Octavia, but her mama calls her Sweet Pea. She lives, she does not live in the housing projects in Atlanta. She's very particular about that. She loves to say, I don't live in the projects. She says, we live across the street from the projects. And for her, this distinction makes all the difference. And she is at home watching television. I like to say for when there are younger people in the audience that, you know, when we were growing up, you got the news at 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock. There was no way in between to find out what happened. And so we would watch the news at this time to see if any more children had vanished. And this is a moment when Sweet Pea is watching television. Her mother works at a factory, and so she's home alone at night, and her mother locks her in. Before she leaves, Mama comes into the room and puts an extra quilt on my bed. She does that no matter what time of year it is. I always make little sleepy sounds when she kisses my forehead, but soon as the lock clicks, my eyes pop back open. I stay in the bed a while longer to make sure she's good and gone. I used to have my feet on the floor as soon as the door shut, but one time she came back to get her sweater. It took some fancy dancing to get out of that one. The first thing I do when I get out of bed is put on my shoes. I get nervous, and I like to be ready to run if I have to. I never had to, but it's good to be ready. And the next thing I do is get my door key from my nightstand. I threaded a shoestring through the hole so I can put it around my neck. I've only had this key for about 2 years. Mama used to just lock the door and shut me in the house, and the door would stay closed till she came back. But three little kids who stay in the projects across the street, they got burned to death while their mama was at work. So after that, we rode the bus to Kmart and got a key made just for me. Once I got everything I need, I head to the living room to watch TV. It was a regular night. I was wrapped up like a mummy in my quilt with the TV turned to the 11 o'clock news. I had watched the 6 o'clock show with Mama, but I like to watch it again at 11 to make sure that everything is still okay. Channel 2 is the best channel because they got Monica Kaufman, a black lady, giving the report. As soon as the theme music went off and the camera zoomed in on Monica, I knew that somebody else was dead. Whenever there was bad news, she took a breath before she talked, like she was fixing to dive underwater. I held my breath too and waited for her to tell us who it was. Please, God, let it be far from here, I prayed right quick. But I should have known that praying makes things worse because it gets God's attention, like with Job. Right there in the middle of the screen was my friend Rodney. Monica has this way of talking about everything like it was just a ribbon cutting downtown or something like that. A 12th child has been reported missing in Southwest Atlanta tonight. Police are looking for information regarding the disappearance of Rodney Green. On and on like that. She said almost the same thing when Jashante next door came up missing. It would seem like there should be some different words to talk about two people that were nothing alike, but all Monica had to say about both of them was that they were gone. And then they showed Rodney's mother and father. They both just said how much they wanted him back, just like Miss Viola had said back in October. And even I was almost the same. I was on this same couch in my same pajamas, staring at this same TV like I had never seen one before. But last time, my mama was with me. We knew Jashante was missing because his mama had been all over the neighborhood looking for him. She knocked on our door twice. You seen Shanti, she said. I had the door locked because my mama wasn't home. No, ma'am, I hollered. She came back again and I said, no, mama came home before Miss Viola came back again. Miss Viola had on a black skirt and yellow and green top. Thick stockings, the color of white ladies, stretched up her legs and tied off at the knee. She sat down at our rickety table while Mama fixed her a cup of black coffee. When was the last time you seen him? Mama asked her. When he went off for school this morning. Mama looked at the clock. It was 9 o'clock at night. She'd only been looking for him since 8. I sat quiet as I could so I wouldn't get sent to my room. You gonna call the police now? You think I should? Yeah, Mama said.
they can help you look. But I got some hot checks at Big Star, some other places around town. Her voice faded out. Sometimes the police pick people up for stuff like that. Viola, Mama said, this ain't no time to be worried about no bad checks. This is your baby. You're right, Miss Viola said, pushing up on the table to get up. Wait a second. Mama put another cup in front of her. You better get another cup of coffee in you before you go talking to the police. Now, why she need to have coffee before she talked to the police? I don't know. She didn't look to me like she was finna fall asleep, but maybe coffee makes you brave. Granny says that it puts hair on your chest, and Mama doesn't let me touch it because she believes it'll stunt my growth. So when they put Jashante on the 11 o'clock news, I was ready, but this Rodney thing caught me by surprise like a cheap trick, like when Leon put vinegar in my thermos at school and I took a big gulp, setting my whole head on fire. I coughed so hard, the vinegar came out my nose and all the kids laughed at me. When I saw Rodney's school picture on the screen with the task force number blinking under it, my crying came hard and sudden like a coughing fit. Then they put a big clock on the screen. It's 11:15. Do you know where your children are? Mama knew where I was, and I knew that she was at the Sunbeam factory making bread and imitation Twinkies. But knowing don't mean nothing if you can't be there. And anyway, by the time a mama can figure out that she don't know where her child is, it's all over with anyway. So I wrote that novel. I was still in my 20s when I wrote it, and I felt like girlhood was still close to the surface of my memory. And I felt like it was a part of my life that I had not seen in a book yet. And I think it was generational. I grew up in Southwest Atlanta. When I say I went to segregated schools, it makes it sound tragic in a world in which it was not tragic. I went to all black schools where we had, you know, I like to say those old school Negro school teachers, you know, that were very concerned with your penmanship and your elocution. You will not do any violence to any verbs in the presence of these ladies. But I had not seen my coming of age represented just because we hadn't gotten old enough yet. Right? Like, I think that a lot of times when you think about write a story that hasn't been written, it kind of implies in there that your own reading has somehow been, you've had deprivation, probably racial. But that wasn't the case for me. It was just generationally, the story had not been told. The title of the novel, Leaving Atlanta, was not only a quiet reference to my own life, but also a reference to how the child murders shook the promise and fantasy of Atlanta as a city too busy to hate. Sweet Pea, my heroine, ends her story by moving to Orangeburg, South Carolina, to live with her father, whom she barely knows. But Atlanta was not a safe place, and her father, a professor, promised to provide her with an education. And as the Greyhound bus pulls away, she muses, I'll be missing my mama for the rest of my life. And when I wrote that line, it was my own homesickness talking. But it was also the beginning of my understanding of Atlanta as an idea, not just a real place. The Great Migration, in which thousands of African Americans fled south in pursuit of jobs and other opportunities up north, is the subject of a wealth of scholarly inquiry. And while the trunk of a black family tree may root in the soil of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, there are fruit-bearing branches as far north as Minnesota, as far west as Los Angeles. But not as much is said about migration within the South. Atlanta's HBCUs, Atlanta has four HBCUs, five. Us, Morehouse, Clark, Morris Brown, ITC, Morehouse School of, we have six HBCUs in Atlanta. And so Atlanta is known as being a hub of a black middle class, like, but it's also created a black middle class. And so many people from small towns in Georgia, Alabama, whatever, they came to Atlanta for their future. I think that the idea of the South as a place of opportunity is underspoken about because the narrative is that you left the South to go North. North is where the jobs are. But a lot of people stayed South and they came to Atlanta. My own daddy came to Atlanta after his older brother Clifton, Uncle Clifton came to Atlanta, sent for daddy, who sent for Uncle Frank, who sent for Uncle Carl. Much in the same migration patterns that people see with people, you know, traveling from country to country. My family traveled from the country to Atlanta. And the thrill was Atlanta had black everything. Black mayor, black school board president, black police chief, black everything. My daddy always said that, black everything. And we had a black mayor. Mayor Jackson was elected 50 years ago this year. And so for a person like me, the child of two PhDs, both of whom were the first in their families to attend college, Atlanta was also the site of a generational divide. And much of the gulf between the generations was just likely a matter of changing society than the location. But in my mind, these were conflated. My daddy, like I said, was from the country where they fought against segregation. My mama participated in the sit-in movement when she was just 14 years old. And they did all of this so their kids could have more. And Atlanta was the more. Atlanta was this gleaming city on a hill. But all of our lives, we knew that our parents had secrets they didn't tell us about. Like, I think the reason they didn't talk about the child murders is that we were in the habit of not talking about that stuff. Like, how can you move forward if the past, if this ugly past that you've worked so hard to escape is on the tip of the tongue? But I always felt like just that my parents had a memory just behind, like, when they met me, that they would never share. And this is something that I tried to encapsulate in the writing that I did, that part of being a Southern person is getting your parents to tell you the truth. I haven't been that successful. That's it, just for the record. If they don't want to tell you, they cannot tell you. But I'm going to read a section from Silver Sparrow in which, in a beauty parlor, a secret is revealed. And it's a story that you may know that you may not have ever thought about. This chapter is called Love and Happiness. On October 18th, 1974, when a really pissed off black woman flung a pot of hot grits on Al Green, her hair was freshly pressed and curled by none other than my mother. As a result of our little brush with Negro history, nobody made Al Green jokes in our house, or even in the Pink Fox, that's her mother's salon, where you can imagine a lot of women fantasize about taking revenge on a lying man. I think the women liked this story, not just because of the drama of it, but because grits were the weapon of choice. The boiling cereal reminded them of being stuck in a hot kitchen, poor and barefoot in the days before they had ever heard of waffles or hollandaise sauce. This girl, whatever her name was, took the entire state of Mississippi and used it to kick somebody's ass. All you had to say was Al Green and grits in the same conversation, and the titter of laughing started, but my mother cut it off with a quiet, "That's not funny." You could hear it, and you couldn't hear it in her voice, but if you looked at her face, the way she closed her eyes and tucked her head down like she was in prayer, you knew that she was serious. The woman who did it was named Mary. The Atlanta Journal said her family name was Sanford, while Jet Magazine called her Woodson. She told my mother she was visiting Atlanta for a few days in order to attend an AME Usher Board convention. Even before she noticed Mary's cross pendant, simple, the jewelry equivalent of two sticks tied together, Mama knew that the woman was saved. Even after what happened next, Mama says she never doubted that Mary had come to Jesus. The truly saved don't have to go around talking about it. They just have this quietness about them, like they know exactly where they're going. Mary walked in on a Tuesday evening, opening the door at 7:30 after Mama had finished her last customer of the night. As a matter of fact, Mama was untying her apron and switching the gas off under the irons when Mary crossed the threshold, looking like a kindergarten teacher at the end of a long day. She wore a pink pantsuit, stylish, but the top stitching on the pockets gave away that it was homemade. Mama said she'll never forget that face, smooth as a brown egg, no lines or crinkles, like she had never laughed or cried in her entire life. And this was not a good night for a late customer. My mama wasn't all that steady on her feet, and this was her first full week of work after her gallbladder operation. These days, they can do the whole thing with lasers and make just a little hole in your belly button. But in 1974, the doctors had to cut you open straight down the middle, gut you like a fish. Mama was laid up for 2 weeks, and during that time, Grandma Bunny came to see about her. When Mary came into the shop, Grandma Bunny was only 2 days gone back home. To make matters worse, I had come down with a cold and a touch of fever. In the corner of the shop, I dozed fitfully on a pallet, coughing and whimpering in my sleep. Besides, it was time for Mama to change the bandage on her wound. "Do you take walk-ins?" Mary asked. "I know you're likely closing up, but maybe you can find it in your heart to help me." Although it was only a couple of weeks into October, something put my mother in the mind of Christmas. Maybe it was just as simple as the name Mary, but Mama felt that God would want her to take this stranger in. "I'm not well, but I might could help you," my mother said, "depending on what it is you need." "I'll tip you good," Mary said, sitting in a chair like my mother had already said yes. She pulled half a dozen bobby pins out of her scrawny bun and unwrapped a red rubber band that came back clotted with hair. "Thank you," she said, "and God bless you." Mama got Mary into the shampoo bowl and half her hair lay down straight and docile under the faucet. That's what happens when you've been getting hard presses for more than 20 years. Some of the kink just gets lost. "Can I talk to you?" Mary asked my mother. "Of course," Mama said. "Nobody in here but us." "I'm leaving my husband," she said. "We're not equally yoked." Mary, like my mother, had married young. Mama didn't say anything one way or another. She just combed through Mary's half-nappy hair, sectioning it off and plaiting it up to dry. "The Bible says that your mate got to be your equal. Y'all have to both love the Lord in the same way." Mary's voice was calm and steady. It was warm for October, so Mama had the door propped to let in the breeze. She could smell burning leaves. "You have children?" she asked. Mary said she had three, but they would be all right with their father. The Lord, she said, had called her to another man. They were going to minister together. This new man was going to take some working on, some praying over, but the Lord was inside him. She could feel it burning through his skin. This boyfriend, Mary said, was chosen. "You ever touch the hand of a preacher that is truly righteous, that has the healing in his hands? You know how it's like he empties out your body and just fills you up with spirit." Mama nodded her head because she had met a preacher like that years ago when she was just a girl. This was after the baby boy had died and she was wandering around looking for somewhere to go. The preacher that touched my mother was a child, a little girl, black as a cast iron skillet with a nurse's cap pinned on her short hair. My mother was walking by, struggling with the basket of laundry, when this girl preacher grabbed her by the arm. Mama felt herself hollowed out and filled with light. This little girl preacher held a white leather Bible in her dark hand. "Will you pray with me?" Mama said she didn't have time, although she was still warm for the child's touch. "Are white people's dirty drawers more important than your soul, sister? Come to me," said the little girl. "Come to me, get on your knees." Mama looked over her shoulder. They were standing in front of the colored high school where Raleigh and James were in class. Mama could imagine the home ec teacher looking out the window and seeing her kneeling in the street with this pickaninny preacher and the basket of laundry beside her. "I can't," Mama said, "I can't." The little girl said, "That's pride. Give me your hand, sister. Your vanity is your burden. Lay it down. Let me touch your soul." My mama extended her hand, greedy for another dose of that touch. The child squeezed her fingers and said, "You don't have to get on your knees. God can touch your heart while you're on your own 2 feet." Mama says her legs just gave out under her and she was on her knees in the road, and that little girl stroked mama's face and talked to Jesus while my mother sobbed. "Ask the Lord to take care of my baby," mama begged the girl. "He'll take care of you too," the girl said, and with every caress of her tiny hands, my mother felt her spirit mend. "So, yes," my mama told Mary, "I have been touched by an anointed preacher, just one time." "This man I got," Mary said, "he sings. No matter what he's singing, he's got God in him. People come to hear him and start crying. They think he's crooning about love between a man and a woman, worldly love, but what he's doing is making them feel Jesus. He is a miracle. We are going to build a ministry together." On my pallet, I woke up sweating and confused. I sat up and called for my mother. I called for her with a sound like a frightened question, like it was the middle of the night and I was all alone. "I'm here, baby," Mama said to me. "Lie back down, okay?" To Mary, she explained. She woke up with a fever this morning. I've been giving her aspirin. "Ginger ale is good too," Mary said. "If you have some fresh ginger, grate some of that in the glass. She won't like it, but it'll help." I called for my mother with a voice full of tears. She set her hot comb down and walked over to me, but didn't bend down to hold me. So I stood up and grabbed her around the legs. "Mary," Mama said, "can you help me? I've been operated on. I can't lift her." "Where's your husband?" Mary said, walking to me. "If she won't let you hold her, don't be hurt," Mama said. "Sometimes she doesn't cotton to new people." "I love children," Mary said. "I have three, two girls and a boy. I miss them, but you have to do what the Lord calls you to do." She reached for me, and I released my mother's knees and held out my arms. I was big for my age, but she lifted me easily. "She's got a bit of a temperature," Mary said to my mother. The story is that she held me in her lap like I was little, even though I was nearly five. I just rested my head on her breast, sweating a dark spot into her pink lapel. After Mama finished pressing Mary's hair, she smoothed it with a boar bristle brush. Mary's fine hair crackled with static. Ghost strands stood up on their own and danced. "It's not just lust when we're together." Mary twisted in a chair and searched my mother's face. Mama said, "I know." Mary didn't want the curls combed out since she was going to have to ride the bus 8 hours to Memphis and she needed her hair to be fresh when she got there. She took Mama's address, writing the street number on a folded index card. "I'm going to write to you when I get everything set up. You have to come meet him. You need to feel that healing touch again. My man is true," she said. "He's true as the word." When she was done, Mama didn't even want to take her money, so Mary tucked a $20 bill in the little pocket of my dress. Mama didn't notice because of all the commotion I caused when Mary tried to leave. She set me down and headed toward the door, and I threw a fit. "Don't go," I said over and over, grabbing for Mary's legs. Mama was so embarrassed that she forgot her condition and bent to pull me away. The pain caught her by surprise, and she staggered a little bit. Mary picked me up and kissed my feverish little face. "Jesus loves you," she said, "and you too, Laverne. You just have to trust and believe." Just then, Daddy came into the shop with Uncle Raleigh close behind, carrying a bucket of chicken. "What's going on here?" he said, reaching for me. He had to pull me because I refused to unhook my arms. "Let her go." He yanked so hard that I started to cry. Mama was embarrassed. "There's nothing wrong. She was just helping me out because my stitches were hurting." "Goodbye, Laverne," Mary said. "Don't let this trouble you none. I'll be seeing you again." When the door clapped shut behind her, my daddy leaned in to kiss my face, but pulled back as a shock hurt his lip. I'm going to skip forward a little bit to a few days later. About 3 weeks later, Daddy came home early on a Wednesday. He walked in the shop while Mama was trying to do three heads at once. Someone was holding me, but this time Daddy didn't pay it any mind. "Laverne, can I talk to you for a second?" he said. Mama wasn't in the middle of anything chemical, so she went outside and sat with Daddy on the porch. "What is it? Everything okay?" "Nothing like that," he said. "I was just wondering. That woman that came in late that night, the one in the pink." "Mary," Mama said. "Mary was her name." "I saw her picture in Jet," Daddy said, handing my mother the folded back page. "She was the one that threw the hot grits on Al Green." "I told you she was crazy." Mama looked at the article, tracing the words, moving her lips as she read what happened in Memphis just one night after Mary left our shop. "What did he do to her?" Mama said. "What did he do to her? She threw a pot of hot grits on the man while he was getting out the bathtub, and you want to know what he did to her?" "Oh, Mary," Mama said. "Black women," Daddy said. "Y'all know y'all is crazy if y'all don't get your way." "Oh, Mary," Mama said again. "Oh, girl." This is not a story my mama tells. To her, it's not just gossip. It's something closer to gospel. One late night, Mama was fixing up a girl who was half bald on the left side from snatching at her own head. She opened her mouth to show Mama where she clamped her jaw so tight that she busted one of her molars. While Mama rubbed Magical Grow into the bald places until her naked scalp shone like it was wet, she shared the story of Mary. You listening, baby? Mama said, when you love a man that much, it's time for you to let him go. That story was interesting to me because I had heard about this woman who threw the grist on Al Green. I had always heard about that. But what I didn't know was that after she threw the grist on Al Green, she took her own life. That's why Al Green found God again. You know, everyone always said, oh, you know, those grits, it wasn't that. It wasn't the grits, it was her blood that caused him. So he gave up secular music and rejoined the ministry. But this woman has become a punchline in her death. And it reminds me of the women who died at Jonestown. How those were mostly Black women who died at Jonestown. And they're now the ones who, quote unquote, whenever someone says, oh, you drank the Kool-Aid, they are referring to all those dead Black women. And they have become a joke. And so I thought about that too in the way, it's like the title of this talk is, you know, Lucille Clifton said, what they call you is one thing, what you answer to is another. And in terms of writing, it's a lot about self-definition and who you say you are and being able to what you answer to and who, and when you write a novel, in my view, when you write a novel and someone, you say in the novel, this is who I am. And when you say, this is who I am, in many ways, you're saying, this is who we are. And your readers answer you by giving you their time and attention. They answer you. Do they answer what you have written? In my fourth novel, An American Marriage, I thought a lot about this. How do you say who you are? Are you heard? An American Marriage is a story of a young couple separated by wrongful conviction. And Celestial, the wife, has to testify on behalf of her husband. She has to say who he is, as she says, who he is to me. And in this, it really made me question the limits of your truth, the limits of your truth. So I'm going to read to you the part when she has to testify to her husband's innocence. And I will tell you that I wrote this during when George Zimmerman was being tried for the murder of Trayvon Martin. Do you all remember Trayvon had a friend? I don't know if she was his girlfriend, but it seemed like she was. And there was a lot of talk over to whether or not she had been a good witness, right? Because she did not seem to be a daughter of the middle class. Her appearance did not seem camera ready. But she was speaking the truth of who her friend was. And it made me wonder, is the truth enough? And under what circumstances is a Black woman believed? So I'm just going to read that little bit. This is Richey's book. And her marginalia is in here. I almost want to do a reading and then step to the side and tell you what she wrote. She was like, wow, crazy. OMG. Okay. It pleases me, though. It pleases me because this is what you answer to. I take it. Okay. This is when she's being called. She knows her husband is innocent because she was with him at the time. What I know now is this. They didn't believe me. 12 people and not one of them took me at my word. There in the front of the room, I explained that Roy couldn't have raped the woman in room 206 because we had been together. I told them about the magic fingers that wouldn't work, about the movie that played on the snowy television. The prosecutor asked me what we had been fighting about. Rattled, I looked to Roy and to both our mothers. Banks objected, so I didn't have to answer. But the pause made it appear that I was concealing something rotten at the pit of our very young marriage. Even before I stepped down from the witness stand, I knew that I had failed him. Maybe I wasn't appealing enough, not dramatic enough, too, not from around here. Who knows? Uncle Banks, coaching me, had said, now is not the time to be articulate. Now is the time to give it up. No filter, all heart. No matter what you're asked, what you want the jury to see is why you married him. I tried, but I didn't know how to be anything other than well-spoken in front of strangers. I wish I could have brought a selection of my art, all images of Roy. I would say, this is who he is to me. Isn't he beautiful? Isn't he gentle? But all I had were words, which are light and flimsy as air. As I took my seat, not even the Black lady juror would look at me. It turns out that I watched too much television. I was expecting a scientist to come and testify about DNA. I was waiting for a pair of handsome detectives to burst in the courtroom at the last minute, whispering something urgent. Everyone would see that this was a big mistake, a major misunderstanding. We would all be shaken but appeased. I fully believed that I would leave the courtroom with my husband beside me. Secure in our home, we would tell people how no Black man was really safe in America. But 12 years is what they gave him. We would be 43 when he was released. Roy understood that 12 years was an eternity because he sobbed right there at the defendant's table. His knees gave way and he fell into his chair. The judge paused and demanded that Roy bear this news on his feet. He stood again and cried, not like a baby, but in a way that only a grown man can cry, from the bottom of his feet up through his torso and finally through his lips. When a man wails like that, you know it's all the tears he was never allowed to shed. As Roy howled, my fingers kept worrying a rough patch of skin beneath my chin, a souvenir of scar tissue. When they did, what I remember is kicking in the door, what everyone else remembers is opening it with a key. After the door was open, however it was open, we were both pulled from the bed. They dragged Roy into the parking lot and I followed, lunging for him, wearing nothing but a white slip. Someone pushed me to the ground and my chin hit the pavement. My slip rode up, showing everything to everyone, and my tooth sank into the soft skin of my bottom lip. Roy was on the asphalt beside me, barely beyond my grasp, speaking words that didn't reach my ears. I don't know how long we lay there, parallel, like burial plots. Husband, wife, what God has brought together, let no man tear asunder. Writing An American Marriage itself was a kind of testimony for me. And I do believe on some level it had an effect on those who heard it. And it allowed me to take my Southern truth all over the world. It's published in 27 countries. I have visited child prisoners. They say they're not prisoners. What do they say? They're child, like, detainees. They had them children in jail. I visited child prisoners in Idaho. They have been there. These kids have been in this juvenile detention center for years. And I visited, I was interviewed on prison radio in London. I played with babies in a women's prison in Dubai. I've been talking about the effects of criminal justice systems on people's lives all over the world. And it has expanded my horizons in ways that I could not have imagined. But the most important thing is that doing this work made it clear to me that it was time to come home. It was time to come back. Writing about Roy's incarceration caused me to articulate his profound homesickness, and it caused me to reckon with my own. It made me question myself as an artist. I noticed that my characters were spending more and more time indoors. So while I completely understand kind of a Southern culture and sensibility, I was losing the landscape. I was becoming, in Atlanta, we changed the names of schools, we changed the names of streets, we changed the names of things all the time in Atlanta. And I no longer felt confident that when I say, like, for example, Confederate Avenue is now United Avenue. I didn't feel confident that I could say what the names of places were anymore because I had been away so long. Also, I was living in Brooklyn. I was drinking coffee in a coffee shop. I looked around the coffee shop and I saw so many major American writers all drinking coffee in the same coffee shop. And if there's a such thing as there's something in the water, if there was something in the water, we were all drinking the same water. And I fear that it's making a sameness about American letters. All of our editors live in Brooklyn. Like, we're all in a very small place that makes for a sameness. And I'm really trying to make the case for everybody going home to write. I didn't want to be a Southern writer in exile anymore. And I think in writing Roy's homesickness, it really drove that clear. I thought that I could be a reverse carpetbagger, like I traveled all over, and instead of pretending to be from wherever I landed, would make it clear to me that I was not from there, And I thought that I could live and kind of straddle the Mason-Dixon line in a certain way. But line straddling is what Morrison would call a thin love, which, you know, she says ain't no love at all. I want to end with Roy's last letter when he finds out. I don't know. I just lost my post-it note. That might not happen. Roy's last letter when he finds out he's going home. His wife is Celestial, and he calls her Georgia, which I think was my subconscious messing with me about the idea of returning to Georgia. He's been in prison for 5 years. They've been estranged. He's been gone a long time, but he's coming back. Dear Celestial, can I still call you Georgia? This will always be my name for you in my head. So Georgia, this is the letter I have been waiting 5 years to write, the words I have been practicing. I even scratched it into the paint on the wall beside my bed. Georgia, I am coming home. Your uncle came through. He went over the heads of these local yokels and ran it straight to the feds. Gross prosecutorial misconduct basically means they cheated. The judge vacated the conviction. The local DA didn't care enough to retry. So, as they say, in the interest of justice, I will soon be home free. Banks can explain it to you all in more detail. I've given him permission, but I wanted you to hear it from me, to see it in my own handwriting, that I will be a free man 1 month from today, in time for Christmas. I know that things have not been right for us, right between us for some time now. I was wrong to take you off my visitors list, and you were wrong not to fight me about it. But this is not a time for blaming each other for what we cannot change. I regret not answering your letters. It has been a year since I have received any word, but how can I expect you to keep writing when you thought I was ignoring you? Did you think I forgot you? I hope I didn't hurt you with my silence, but I was so hurt myself and also ashamed. Will you hear me when I say that the last 5 years are behind me and behind us, water under a bridge? I know that we can't start love over, but this is what I do know. You have not divorced me. All I want is for you to tell me why you have chosen to remain my lawfully wedded wife. Even if someone else is occupying your time, you have chosen to keep me as your husband these many years. In my mind, I picture us at our same kitchen table, in our same comfortable house, passing quiet words of truth. Georgia, this is a love letter. Everything I do is a love letter addressed to you. Thank you. And now I am happy to take any questions you may have. I am friendly and approachable. Approach me, yes.
Oh, that was lovely. Thank you so much. As I was listening, I noticed that religion and ritual come up in such an almost sensuous way in a lot of your writings, like the ritual of the little girl that's waiting for her mother to leave the room so that she can go and watch the 11 o'clock news, or even the ways that the women are in the hair salon, and also the memories of the woman is invoking as well. I'm wondering if you could talk about that.
I am interested. I'm very interested in religion. I'm a Southerner that was raised in a home without religion. My parents are both preachers' kids. And my parents are actually now divided on their whole religion question. My mother has like completely gotten back into it. But we would go visit my grandparents who are very religious, and they would like religious us up. In the summer, we went to vacation Bible school, like the whole nine. My grandparents were like, we are not going to jeopardize these children's souls because their parents have lost their minds. And so it made me kind of self-aware about religion, because I felt like Christianity was something we did in the summertime. And I was always very drawn to it. I was very drawn to the scripture and all the rituals around it. And I feel that I express it more in my writing, that it's a space where I get to do that. Because it feels organic to me. I wrote a piece for the New York Times about when you're a child and you have to say a Bible verse, and I would always say Jesus wept because it's the shortest one. And I just felt like my cousins were looking at me like, you know, like they were like, see, you live in Atlanta, your daddy don't go to church, and you don't even know no Bible verses. And so I learned the whole 23rd Psalm The whole one. Yay, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, thou art with me. I could go all the way, anointing the head and oil, all of it. And I remember that moment was the first time I had what kind of felt like a religious experience. Like I felt transported by that. And I often, when I'm writing, I kind of feel that same thing. And I try to get it on the page as best I can. Yes, Mindy.
I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question, but although I knew you before I read Living in Atlanta, I felt like I was introduced to you really by that, particularly by the way you approach, for lack of a more elaborate phrase, love. In that, I mean, by the time we got to Sweet Pea's story, focusing on Sweet Pea, I realized that, or I felt like that it had been built up there was the kind of private ways that we love each other and build each other up and how that's a whole brilliant survival strategy. And I just wondered, you know, I also took a long time to read the novel because of what it was about, because I also grew up in that time. But then I was also surprised by both the beauty of that love and like also the faithfulness of the character T.R. in that novel and how she comes up and how there's these moments that like lighten the heaviness, but they're also more like life than they are like leading us in the novel. So I wonder if you could say something about what you were trying to do with all those heavinesses and lightnesses and focuses on love. Not just in that novel, but I see it now throughout, you know, throughout the work.
First, thank you for that careful reading. We are one thing I've always believed is that Black people are, we're more than our suffering. And I think everyone has something about their life that someone could decide is a suffering that should define you but doesn't. I think we've all had that experience where you've told someone about something that happened to you and they can't believe you're walking around. Like you're just like, what? It's just part of life. It isn't life. The child murder specifically, one thing that came of the child murders is that as a Black child, we felt very loved during that period. People all over the country were trying to save our lives. I remember when the children from New York sent us their milk money. It was in a large trunk, like a trunk you would think on a pirate ship. And it was filled with dimes and nickels. The children from New York sent all their lunch money. They collected it and they shipped it to Atlanta to help. The Black men of Atlanta, there were three different approaches to how they were going to save the children. The mayor, was sitting at a table with a big table full of money, and he was going to give this money to anyone who could solve the murders. So we got to see someone trying to save us with money. We also saw, the Nation of Islam guys were out walking, you know, trying to look intimidating in their bow ties and everything. And kids, we weren't that impressed because we were just like, how can they save you in church shoes? They can't chase somebody. And then the third way that people were going to save us were the unemployed men of Atlanta formed an organization they called the Bat Patrol, B-A-T. And they walked through the city with baseball bats and they would walk around and they would handle anything they saw. And we, children, we could get behind that. We were like, I can see that. The mayor was like, absolutely not. Like we are trying to be the convention center hub of the South. We are not having unemployed Black men walking around with baseball bats downtown. Absolutely not. But I remember it as a time being incredibly flattering as a child. And we were also given a lot of the things that children should have. Like there were all these after school programs. So kids who didn't have any place to go after school now had ballet lessons. You know, I took tap. Toe heel, you know, like we got to do all these things. And that is also what I remember. Like, Lucille Clifton has a quote for everything. But what she said, they want me to remember their memories, but I keep remembering mine. I remember, like I also remember the brave mothers, the mothers of the children organized. And they made something that was like, they were all, they had like tenants meetings for, to make more affordable housing. And they had a, it was called the Committee to Stop the Children's Murders. And these women were maligned. They helped would hold galas to raise money for the investigation, and they would not invite the mothers because they were poor, because they didn't have good grammar, because they didn't look like what Atlanta should be. They came anyway. Yes, they did. And so I remember that as well. And so that's what I do when I write. I try to remember the whole thing that happened. The whole thing. Yes, ma'am.
On the same topic, I have confessed that I had not been aware of your novel on the title of Joplin. The only one I knew was studying in the arts. And so, obviously, you were aware when you wrote this. What were you interested in doing that was different from hers? She told hers was more.
A little conspiracy in there too. It's a little side order conspiracy also in her novel.
Yes.
Well, actually, her novel came out at the same time as mine, Almost Died. Can you imagine? Here you are, somebody's first-time novelist. You're writing your book on the Atlanta child murders, and then you see in Publishers Weekly that the late, great Tony K. Bombara's posthumous novel on the Atlanta child murders is coming out, edited by none other than Toni Morrison. I was like, I quit. I just quit. But, so my book was done when her book came out. Hers came out maybe 6 months before mine. But here's one thing that I knew. People think that, like even Baldwin's Evidence of Things Not Seen, people think that child murder is something that happens to parents. Like when I would tell people, I grew up in a child murder, they would say, oh my God, your poor mother. Like that's, no one really was thinking about the generational effect of it. And see, the difference between the way children experience the child murders and adults is that children have no sense of history. Our parents saw this as a continuation of the racial violence they had grown up with. They felt like we thought we had escaped, and now this racial violence has come back. Children have, and because children also are seen as symbolic. People, you know, I believe that children are the future. People think children are the future. Children think, don't think of themselves as the future, right? It's like how Margaret Atwood said, to little children don't see one another as cute. To each other, they are life size. And so that's how we felt. We felt that we were living our lives, and we did not understand it as part of a continuum. And I think so that way, in writing from children's point of view, it was, my story is more in the moment and has more pleasure in it. Because there is pleasure in childhood. There is still candy to be shoplifted from the local store. You know, there's still these things to be done. And I think in writing the child's point of view, even though ironically we were the targets of the violence, I feel that we were more able to multitask our lives during the violence because we did not have the weight of history. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much. My question is maybe another novel without Roy going to jail.
Okay.
Going to prison. Why did he have to go to prison? Given the social meaning of prison and experience of the black people. What would be an alternative way of writing about the love without that experience?
You know, Roy also was like, why did I have to go to prison? I mean, I do think the idea of, like, in some ways, prison is the boogeyman under the bed, right? Like, there's this sense of he did everything right. He went home to the small town where he's from and, like, prison. You know, he got away from where he was from. And it seemed like he had put that possibility behind him. And then he goes home for a short visit, and it comes to get him. And he feels like it's almost fated. I do think that people often ask me, had Roy not gone to prison, would this marriage have survived? People ask me that a lot. And my answer is, we don't know. What was taken from them was figuring out if their marriage would survive or not. Like whether or not they would wreck their own marriage as opposed to having it wrecked. And I think that's really what this took from him, was this agency over the events of their marriage. And I also think about her.
You know, she says she grew up feeling like people say, well, when you're Black, you have to be twice as good to get half as much, right? I mean, we've all been told that. Well, this is the case for her in the issue of marriage. Just to stay married, all kinds of random people stay married, right? Like, I'm sure there's random people in this room that are successfully married without any heroic effort. But she would have had to be a superhero to remain married. And that really was one of the issues that I was looking at. But I think if Roy had not gone to prison, I don't know, you think they would have stayed together? Who's read this book? You think they would have stayed together? Mindy's like, nah, it was done. Do you think so? She says yes. What do you think? Rashay, would they have stayed together? I can look at your margin notes and tell you. But she has things in the margin like, that's cold-blooded. Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to swing us back to your opening comments where you talked about how much you've traveled from place to place and your final comments about having to feel like you really needed to get back to America. You feel like you were beginning to lose that connection, right, to America. And just, it brought to mind the comment that my dissertation advisor had mentioned to me that sometimes it's important to get away from the place that you are in order to be able to write about it. And I wondered where you wrote your books and whether you felt that being in different locations, having traveled so much, in a sense, pushed you to think about it, you know, what you wanted to write in a different kind of, in a way that you might not have if you had stayed in Atlanta and not done this level.
I do think that being away from home made me realize what Atlanta was. Like, who was I telling today? I was talking to somebody today that I did not believe that America was a majority white country. Did I tell y'all that? I had heard this. But I felt about white people being the majority in America the way you feel when people tell you the earth is 80% water. You're like, okay, I've seen a map. I get that, but in your heart, don't you feel like if the earth was 80% water, how are we sitting here? You know, you believe it, but you don't believe it. And that's how I felt. And then when I moved to Iowa, it became abundantly clear. And that clarity did inform my writing. I don't know if it informed it for the better or not, but it did change have a feeling of writing as a form of pushing back in a way that I did not understand writing as pushing back when I was a student at Spelman College. To me, at Spelman College, being a Black woman writer felt like I was going with the tide. And I think that it probably gave a little more edge to what I'm doing when I found out in Iowa. Yes.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was really interesting. What inspired you to write? When did you know you were a good storyteller?
Well, I always loved to read and to write as a child, you know, but what I didn't know is that I could be a writer. I didn't know that what I was writing could be important because I think I was telling somebody, I've talked to so many people since I've been here, so if you already heard this, I'm sorry, but when I was coming up as a child, if you were a girl and you liked to read and write, people thought it was about your character, that you were nice, a nice girl in the library. No one ever asked me, what are you reading? What are you reading? What are you writing? But when I was in college, I met a writer and she was my teacher. And she said to me once, what are you thinking about these days? And I got ready to tell her, I wanted to say something smart. And she says, no, don't tell me. Write it down. And in that, she became my first audience. And I started to feel like what I wrote mattered. I mostly wrote short stories, not because of any real affinity for the form, but it's really all I thought I had in me. Like, I remember the first time I managed to make a story extend past 10 pages. I felt like, okay, I'm on the way. The first novel I wrote was a dog of a novel. It was terrible. But I felt like I wrote it, it's complete. And I know it's not good, I knew it wasn't good, but it was complete.
And I felt like, okay, if I can write a bad novel, I can write another novel and it could be a little better. And if that one's not good enough, I could write another one, it could be a little better. And that's how I came to become a novelist. And I look back on it and I'm actually very grateful that I did not have more encouragement. I used to be bitter. Oh, bitter is too strong of a word. What's next to bitter? I was bitter, but I was bitter like a Negroni, you know, like just somewhat bitter, but still delightful. Because I felt like nobody encouraged me. I wasn't encouraged. You know, my parents didn't think I was going to be a writer. And I would fantasize about what my life would have been like if I had had all this encouragement. But I now know that you just need someone to encourage you. Everybody doesn't need to encourage you. And as I told a class also, I think the way life kind of knocks you around when you're trying to be an artist, you have to be strong enough to peck your way out of your own eggshell, right? You can't expect someone to take a spoon and tap the eggshell and lift off the, you know, you have to be able to peck your way out of your own eggshell. I don't know what that's gonna look like on the video, but, So that's what I believe. You gotta pick your way out. Yes.
I have a nosy question.
Uh-oh, here we go.
I wanna know what cafe in Brooklyn you're writing at all.
It's right across from Green Light Bookstore.
Okay. I'm from California, so I wouldn't know, but I want to know.
You know, but you know, now I hear that after the pandemic, so many of those cafes have shut down. But in Brooklyn, you can see anybody in
the
cafe.
This is a follow-up then, because I want to know what it's like to be in that coffee shop with all of these other writers and know that what, like, for me, I imagine I'd be like nosy about what is it that they're writing, what's going on. Is there a community there? Like, what it feels like to sit in that coffee shop and drink the same coffee? Because when I, for example, am in the archive doing work, it's hard for me to concentrate on my own work because I walk in and I'm like, I wonder what everybody else is looking at, what they're writing. I don't know.
I think at first, when you first get to Brooklyn, you're shocked by all the writers. You're like, oh my goodness, are those the Jonathans? Oh, there's, you know, but after a while you get over seeing them. I think you get used to them. But I think one thing that was odd about living in Brooklyn was that it was exotic if you met someone they had not written a novel. Like if you meet someone and they say they haven't written a novel, you're like, really, you haven't? Like that's the person you want to talk to at the party. So you just didn't write it. You just woke up this morning and did what? That is fascinating. No books. Like that's, the writers are so oversaturated there in that way. But the challenge of living there is that you constantly compare yourself to other people. You know too much of other people's business. You got to keep your eyes on your own paper. And that's why I broke up with the internet for a while. I broke up with the internet because I feel like Instagram is Brooklyn in your phone. And I needed to get away from that and just listen to the voices of in my own head and try to write the book that I think needs to be written and not worry about what other people are doing. I think it's an important lesson no matter where you live, because comparison is the enemy of not just your happiness, but of art, I believe. Yes, last question. She had that like wrapping it up energy.
And the isolation of it all, like just on normal Saturday after Eastdale Mall with my family, as we were pulling out of the parking lot, there was a long black car, the type that people would refer to as a Batmobile, or it was kind of like in that horror film, the car, and it was right behind us as we pulled out, and then pulled on down the bypass, and not to overthink that, but then when we turned on the interstate, it turned onto the interstate, and you know, passing the first exit and then the second one, and then it got off at our exit, and all the while I'm taking furtive glances back, trying to think, oh my goodness, is someone in there gonna get me, you know? And then when we got off the interstate, then oh, my nerves just kind of went overboard because they got off too, and then they made the same left turn under the bridge that we made, and then the same right one. I mean, I was just a bundle of nerves, like internally. As a child, my family was just having a normal conversation all around. And then we went on down the Carter Hill Road, which runs down beside our street, and we turned onto my street, and then it went on down the Carter Hill Road. I have never felt relief before or since like I felt in that moment to see that car pass on. And the melodrama that played out in my mind was very visceral, and I think, too, of what it meant to watch the news, as you refer to here, and to hear that I'm saying every night, it's 10 o'clock.
Do you know where your children are?
Yes. That was the motif, the mantra, night after night. The question I have is about, and I guess it's Southern Studies too, but when we think of the concept of daughter in American letters, but Southern letters especially, sometimes it's invoked in a very reactionary way, as in, for instance, the daughters of the Confederacy. And think about what it means to reclaim the idea of the daughter. And especially as Black women who grew up in the South, who were born in the South, I think it has a very different meaning. And I would love to hear you maybe speak to what those meanings have become that are very different, and in some ways even insurgent, related to the specificity of, you know, Black cultural experience.
Well, you know, you think about, and you know, for me, this is something me and Anne have in common. All roads lead back to Morrison. And you know, there's an Tar Baby when Undine tells Jadeen, you don't know how to be a daughter. And what she means by that is you don't know what it is to serve, like what it is to be, serve is so strong of a word, but she's saying you don't know what it, you know, you're the daughter, you're the one that takes care of your parents. You take care of that older generation. And in that way, I think people resist it. And, you know, as a daughter, you like being a native daughter is different than being a native son, right? But in reclaiming it, I like to think of myself as a daughter of the South, as a steward of stories, of what has been passed on. That is the way that I like to think about it. And even claiming the word South, I mean, there, I used to eat my heart out because I was never invited to any Southern literary things. I was only invited to Black things, but I was never invited to anything Southern. And I felt like I was fighting my way in. Like when I was inducted into the Fellowship of Southern Writers, I was like, that's right. You know, like I am a member of this thing, where all my white colleagues were like feeling so pigeonholed regionally. They're like, we're more than Southern Writers. And it's very interesting that they were trying to cast it aside where I was trying to put on that cloak. And I think it's important as Southerners that we claim that this is who we are. I mean, I think that, you know, the famous remarks of Outkast at the Source Awards when he said the South got something to say, that claimed the urban South for Atlanta. Or even like, what Usher, y'all saw Usher at the halftime Super Bowl? He said, I brought the world to Atlanta. What did he say about Atlanta to the world? He said, I brought the world to Atlanta, I think. But anyway, yes, you know, and that's an exciting way of, you know, claiming Southernness. But I also want to claim the South for Black women. And I want to claim the South, the urban South, as part of the South. You know, people think Southern literature is about grandmothers and mules, right? And I've never seen a mule. I wouldn't know a mule if it walked in here. Right? I mean, I guess like through process of elimination, we can figure out what it is. But what I'm saying is that rural agrarian experience is not mine, but it is, in fact, Southern. I want Southern to be a bigger tent. Whew, I'm tired. We good, y'all? Thank you.